Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Judy Hyde, who's the president of the United Nations chapter of Northeastern Connecticut, and Charlie Pruitt, who's an activist, an anti-Star Wars activist, former chemist on the Manhattan Project, and lived in Muslim countries for 9 years.
Ten.
And including Afghanistan.
And Pakistan.
Now, the original reason that I invited you to come speak here on the show was before September 11th. You had sent out a letter, Judy had sent out a letter, announcing the impending dissolution of the United Nations Association chapter here in Mansfield in Northeast Connecticut. And Judy is the president of the chapter of the UNA. The reasons that you gave had to do with your growing disillusionment of your whole chapter, not just yourself, with the United Nations and its co-optation. So let's talk about that. The flip side of our lack of commitment and our persistent U.S. persistence efforts to undercut the United Nations is that the United Nations has been weak, undercut, and compromised. So talk about a little bit about how your chapter came to talk about first about when the chapter was formed and how it came to be, and then how it came to be disillusioned.
In June of 1998, Irv Stolberg came up here and did a very stirring presentation about the importance of the United Nations and the need for us to strengthen the United Nations Association, which is a freestanding nonprofit whose mission is really to strengthen the United Nations.
And he was director of the statewide organization,
right,
and former speaker of the House and the legislature, Irv Stolberg.
Yes. So he very much wanted to have an active chapter going here, and some of us stepped up to the plate and agreed to do that. I became president by default and have been trying for since then to build up the membership and to bring more awareness to international affairs here in this part of the state, along with the World Federalist Association, which was already an existing chapter. And so we worked with them, alongside them, and together tried to increase awareness.
And let's talk about the difference between UFA and WFA for a second. The World Federalist Association is committed to the strengthening of what we used to refer to as world government before that term took on such ominous overtones for people. But it's committed to the strengthening of world governance institutions, giving the United Nations or some other bodies tax powers, law enforcement powers, and so on and so forth. And so the United Nations Association, strictly speaking, doesn't have that kind of agenda.
No. They have some core issues. Certainly one is for the United States to pay their dues. Yeah. And then it's supporting the International Criminal Court and the United States stepping up to the plate on the other international treaties and conventions, signing on to those.
Keep space for peace only. No militarization of space. We signed that treaty back in 1964, UN treaty.
Yeah. So, as we worked along, we discovered more and more about sort of the workings of the United Nations Association and became aware right away that at the same time that we came into existence, the United Nations Association had developed a special relationship with something called the Business Council of the United Nations, which had been a freestanding organization, and they merged. And they merged, as far as we could tell, without any real review by the membership of the organization. And some red flags went up for us, and we began to pay attention to the degrees to which the United Nations as a whole or particular agencies within might be having to capitulate to the pressure of corporations. We were particularly aware of things happening at UNICEF, where that is governed and has been governed very purely about a code of marketing, and became aware of some very...
Around the Nestle's boycott?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
of ways in which those formula producers were really being successful in violating the code, and the ways in which there was capitulation that was very, very troubling because it really meant the lives of children.
Which really is ironic because the U.S. has pulled out of so many U.N. institutions. We didn't pull out of UNICEF, did we? But we pulled out of UNESCO.
Right. No, we didn't pull out of of UNICEF.
Yeah.
Then Kofi Annan developed something called the Global Compact in, I think it was the summer of 99, and then the red flags got waving more wildly for us as we began to understand really what was involved in that, and that this was sounded good enough on the surface. It sounded pretty noble and good. He was trying to get corporations to really cooperate and to adhere voluntarily to UN principles of human rights and child labor and those kind of things. The trouble with the Global Compact was that it didn't have any teeth to it. It didn't have any requirement that corporations had to be good guys. They were supposed to be good guys, but just after he did that, he accepted Shell Oil Corporation as one of the partners, and they are, you know, notorious violators of human rights. So on the one hand, they were saying that they had standards, but on the other hand, they weren't adhering to those standards. So the fact that there was no monitoring built in and that they were bringing on kind of the wrong partners, and also this idea of partnership, it struck us as totally inappropriate. You can't have a partnership with an entity that has different goals from you. So we saw it as a real boon for the corporations who could kind of wrap themselves in the blue flag of the United Nations and look good. They had to have a website where they could say what they were doing, and they could just come up with like one good thing they'd done in that year and in order to be a viable part of this undertaking. But then they could be doing all these other things that were strictly in violation. So we developed a resolution to take to the Biennial Convention to ask the UNA to really take a look at this, to study it, to think about its implications, rather than just hopping on the bandwagon and endorsing that. Well, we had a delegation of five of us. We were the biggest delegation from any place in the country, and we were very proud to say that ours was the only resolution which was just roundly and soundly rejected.
You were seen as some kind of outside agitator cell that had infiltrated the UNA.
Well, maybe. I don't know. They didn't
rebels.
Say. We were rebels. So, and the president of the organization, the UNA, actually got up to the mic and was one of the loudest voices saying this was awful and terrible and we could never sign on. Because, in fact, the UNA gets corporate money to support it, too. And so there seemed to us a real conflict of interest there. But thanks to Irv Stolberg, he helped us politically to figure out how to kind of reconcile some of our issues with another resolution and get some of our language in there. And then we withdrew our resolution and went on our way. So then we came back from New York and really did some soul searching about...
Let's take a step back. You had been doing a study group within the UNA as well on globalization.
Yes, we had been.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Tell us a little bit about that.
You want to talk about that, Charlie?
Well, we had a series of several meetings on the concept of globalization with some speakers. We studied it, and we came up that we were pretty much opposed to globalization the way it is now perceived. In fact, in this Vision 2020 that I mentioned earlier, it says outright, globalization is going to increase the gap between the poor and the rich. And it is imperative that we control space so we can control our business interests or defend our business interests around the world. So looking at it that way, we're against globalization if it's going to do that. Globalization in increasing communication, increasing transportation, increasing the knowledge of one group of another group, that's all good. But globalization, where our business interests and that of the Western world impinges on and degrades the way of life of the third world, we do not support.
So this combined conscious reasoning on your own part, the confrontation with the UN co-optation by corporate interests and your own globalization studies, and probably the rising tide of anti-globalization sentiment around the country and the world that you're aware of, this seemed to have contributed to your sense of disillusionment.
It certainly did, and also kind of getting the feeling that the grassroots of the organization weren't as important to it as the upper management's political agenda. So we notified our membership that we as a board were laying down this work, and we certainly left opening if anybody else wanted to step forward and carry it on. But to date, nobody has come forward to do that. So I assume that means that that's the end of this chapter, but it's by no means the end of our work. And we have just gone through a metamorphosis as a group of people concerned about the state the world's in. And we have a new name. You want to hear our new name?
Sure.
Our new name is an acronym that's called HOPFROG. And HOPFROG stands for the Hub of Ordinary People Finding Responses to Oppressive Globalization. And so this is a group it's open to anybody who's working on anything in the Northeast that has anything to do with business interests taking over the world, or and actually almost any activist issue you want fits in very nicely. And we get together once a month to hear what we're each doing and to support each other. And it's a support group for local activists. But now, since September 11th, there, of course, has been such an extraordinary upsurge of active involvement from all kinds of people in all kinds of ways, and other groups meeting and other initiatives going on, and all kinds of protests and vigils and meetings of all kinds going on, that it's all gotten very confusing to know what anybody's doing anymore. Everybody's just going in all kinds of directions right now.
Mm-hmm. One of my political gurus was Michael Harrington, and he was always able to find a silver lining in every cloud, every political cloud on the horizon. And so I've been arguing with people about what silver linings there might be in this context. Silver linings such as an increase in social solidarity. That may make it much more difficult to pursue the kind of radically libertarian, beggar the poor policies that the Republicans have been trying to pursue. It may make arguments for national health insurance much more cogent if we're all in the same boat together and healthcare costs are going up, and folks who are part of this national boat that we're in need support. And it may make more cogent our multilateralist interests. Do you see those kind of opportunities?
I don't. I see just the opposite. I think we're... well, what is it? Bush has a rating now of 90%, and 85% said war is fine even if we kill innocent people. And we're rallying behind the most conservative elements of the politics of this nation. Rumsfeld, Rice, and Cheney. I don't see us getting out of this for years into where we really could get back to some progressive social concerns. Plus, this terrible tax cut he's got has so impoverished the country. And I think, I believe Reagan had the same idea as Bush. Let's impoverish the federal government so we have to cut the social programs because we're opposed to the social programs. And let's enrich the rich because they're the ones that's going to move the economy forward. Yes, they're going to put it in their pockets.
Right. Well, we're returning to military Keynesianism. We're going to run up probably a deficit in military spending while having given back, as you said, $1.5 trillion to tax cuts mostly for the rich. But I was impressed this week that Alan Greenspan went to Congress, and he was opposed to any further tax cuts. He didn't sound at all like a Republican. He was arguing for, if anything, public spending, so $100 billion in public spending to stimulate the economy. So.
Well,
there, there are signs.
Glad to hear Greenspan's doing something good for a change.
Right.
Well, I'd like to say just one word in defense of the United Nations. And this is my own idea. I have not seen this or heard it anywhere. But they are so impoverished. They were practically bankrupt. They're taking the money from the nations that are supposed to get it for sending their troops out to as peacekeeping forces, and using it to run the United Nations. And of course, it's largely due to our indebtedness of $1.3 billion or something to the UN. And I think that Kofi Annan and the leaders up there were just desperate, and they saw this cooperation with the corporations, perhaps, as a way of getting some money to keep the thing viable. I have no idea whether that was behind it or not, but it's just what it seems to me could make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And if it keeps the United Nations going, well, I guess that's good. I'm sorry about the way it has to go. But I see that Congress just released some $500 million of what we owe the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to send it there, and that'll help them.
Right. Well, that's a good sign.
That is a good sign.
Yeah. Now, let's talk militarily for a second. You've been around through Korea. You're pretty young folks back during the Korean War, I suppose, but the Vietnam
World War II.
World War II, the Vietnam War. in the current situation, there are a number of places around the world where blue helmets are keeping the peace or have been established as an effort to keep people apart in Yugoslavia and other places. But there is no offensive capability built into the UN military structure. In general, when blue helmets are deployed, they are defensive as opposed to offensive. Do you think that the creation of special units or special forces on the part of some kind of multinational consortia under the United Nations would be a step forward, some kind of anti-terrorism task force under a multinational command?
Oh, that's Chapter 10 of the UN Charter, that they have a international police force. Police operate under the law. Armies operate outside the law, lawless, that they have this police force that can be sent to any trouble spot on the earth. And that's a standing, I think they want 10,000 or something like that, a standing group that could be sent immediately. In addition, Kofi Annan and others in the United Nations have wanted enough money to be able to send out groups to study areas where there seem to be incipient trouble coming up and to be able to stop it before it breaks out in war.
Mm-hmm. So this has already been on the table. Kofi Annan's already asked for that kind of authority?
Well, it's not only Kofi Annan. They've thought of that for a long time in the UN.
Mm-hmm.
But they just don't have the money and the wherewithal to develop such a group within the United Nations.
Right.
And they don't have the police force either, and that was authorized in the charter. And it ends up that Kofi Annan has to be up there begging countries to send troops.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up not having enough money to pay him.
Mm-hmm. And that's, isn't it principally the U.S.'s resistance that has stopped the creation of those multilateral forces?
Oh.
Because the paranoids in the Congress?
Most excellent example is Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
Our ambassador in Rwanda got to the State Department and said, you've got to send some troops down here.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be genocide, slaughter, massacre. Send some troops down. And the UN people down there said the same thing. And Clinton said, no, no, no. And he remembered politically Somalia and dragging them through the streets. This is, I don't know what he thought, but he might think this is not good for me politically. And he refused to do it and held back the United Nations from sending any. And as a result, 800,000 people were slaughtered in 8 weeks. And that's better than Hitler ever did. Well, Clinton afterwards said, I'm sorry, we should have sent somebody. But yes, we have held people back all over the world from participating in a in peace programs and in befriending problems erupting throughout.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Other topics you want to talk about?
Surely, I'd like to talk about a simple solution I came up with my simple mind.
Simple solution to your simple mind? Or?
No, through your simple mind. Simple mind.
Okay.
I don't have any resolution of my problems internally. Use the United Nations to funnel money, military money, from the countries of the world that are spending $1 trillion a year on the military. We are going to spend $340 billion next year. We spent $5 trillion on nuclear weapons since 1940. Funnel some of that money through the United Nations to alleviate some of the terrible poverty throughout the world. If you alleviate poverty and injustice, you will get rid of the root causes of war. Well, and we won't have to worry about terrorists.
That abstract formula has not been brought home to people in a very concrete way in the past. And in this situation, when people stare at what's happened in Afghanistan, the fact that we provided $3 billion to destroy that country when fighting against the Soviets, and then as soon as the Soviets left, we cut off our aid to zero and allowed the country to fall into chaos with warring warlords, didn't help with any kind of peaceful new government come into power there. It seems to be brought home to a lot of people. I've heard a number of commentators talk about the fact that we need to couple humanitarian aid and sustained attention in that region with our military intervention, or else we'll just breed more terrorism.
And all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Africa. Oh, that's a basket case.
Mm-hmm.
And the poverty there is abysmal.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't need to be. $10 billion, that's B, billion, not trillion,
right.
$10 billion will provide clean, safe drinking water for everybody on this globe.
Right.
Can you imagine how the people
that's,
of the
that's
world...
That's one quarter of what we appropriated on September 12th.
Yeah.
Right.
And can you imagine how the people of the world would look at the United States if we took a paltry $10 billion out of the military budget and gave everybody clean water? They would look at us as the great savior.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the great Satan. And we could give a little of those billions to better health care, better education.
Let's talk for just a second about the cultural underpinnings of the United Nations, however. The United Nations is really a product of liberal democracies attempting to create a liberal democratic framework at an international level. I don't think that Islamic countries would have ever created a United Nations. Isn't there something inherent in the structure of a multicultural, liberal, democratic institution like the United Nations that is intrinsically Western and therefore perhaps in cultural conflict with the civilizations such as Islam?
Well, I don't like the sound of it because it borders on demonization of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very readily accepted throughout the Western world now. As we've said, I lived in Muslim countries for years. I found some very, very nice people there, very hardworking people, very peaceful people. The Sufis of Islam are just the most peaceful people you can find. And the word Islam itself comes from the Muslim greeting one to the other, salam. And salam means peace. When they say hi to each other, we say hello. They say salam. They say peace to each other. We might learn a little something from that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Muslim countries of the world would go along with us and accept a world organization that would be for peace. I think they're going to proselytize throughout the world. But what's new?
Mm-hmm.
Christianity's done that ever since its inception,
mm-hmm.
including the Crusades,
mm-hmm.
which our dear president said we were going to start.
That's right. Well, the reason I bring this up is because after the Cold War finished, Again, the United Nations was weakened considerably by the structure that allowed the Soviet Union and China to have a veto power within the Security Council, and the fact that there was a Cold War, and it was impossible for these two blocs to ever agree about anything within the structure of the United Nations. And then it seemed after the Cold War was over that there might be an opportunity for multilateral institutions to take on a new relevance. But with this growing apparent clash between at least certain sectors of the Islamic world and the West, part of which is fueled by their own rejection of globalization, of the economic globalization, it seems like there may be, a set of civilizational differences which may weaken our ability to find multilateral solutions.
Where do you find in the Islamic code of belief this opposition to working together?
Well, you're right. I mean, there are certainly examples of religious tolerance in Islamic history of where people of other religious beliefs have lived under Islamic rule, and Christian-based societies have had equally intolerant and tolerant periods. So there's nothing intrinsic, but it may be, I mean, for instance, Marxist-Leninism, I think, was a doctrine. I don't think that Marxist-Leninist countries would have, of their own accord, created a liberal democratic institution. They never had liberal democracy inside themselves. And so there's some kind of question about whether the structure of a United Nations that allows a diversity of belief and many different points of view can be created by societies which are not themselves democratic. And so I guess it's not so much Islam itself, but the need to create democracy in Africa and the Arabian Peninsula and other countries.
One of the reasons we don't have any democracy in some of those countries is because we have installed tyrannical dictators who sell us oil ridiculously cheap. You can name them. Mm-hmm. The Shah of Iran, Saddam Hussein, we gave him the power that he's got when he was fighting Iran. King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, the Emir of Kuwait, we put all those people in there and keep them there because we get oil. Mm-hmm. That's our oil.
Right.
Well, the Muslims don't believe that. The Arabs say, that's our oil. And that oil should be, profits should be going to the poor people in our countries, not to the rich 100 princes, sons of King Fahd, and to the people in the United States to run around in 10 miles to the gallon huge automobiles.
Right. Really want to thank you for coming to speak with us today. Judy Hyde, who's the outgoing president of the United Nations Association. Tell us again the name of the organization that you guys have just started.
HopFrog.
HopFrog. Which stands for?
The Hub of Ordinary People, Finding Responses to Oppressive Globalization. I'm also part of another group called EGG, and that stands for Economic Globalization Group.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure being here with you today. Thanks.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.